On a hot summer evening in 1992, neighbors heard the familiar sound of an argument coming from the Campano residence. According to Christopher Campano, his wife left the house shortly after their argument to calm down. Karen Campano was never seen again. Karen Campano was just 2 weeks shy of her 43rd birthday when she disappeared. She had just come back to Oklahoma City after visiting her three children who were living in New York, back to the home she shared with her third husband, Chris.
She come back from New York and she went to talking about moving back because of her family, and she's upset.
Chris and Karen Campano were married in December of 1987. Friends described them as an odd couple. She was 15 years older than Chris, and it was her third marriage, his first. They were introduced to one another by Karen's best friend, who also happened to be Chris's mother. Chris was a drifter, worked construction jobs, and spent some time in jail for petty theft. Karen was the main wage earner, working as a bill collector for this credit adjustment company in town. On the evening of July 1st, 1992, Chris and Karen had one of their frequent arguments, this time over his use of drugs.
And I was into drugs, and she was, you know, nagging at me and trying to get me in drug programs, and, you know, just trying to help.
It was loud enough for the neighbors to hear.
I could hear Karen screaming, and no, please, please, and don't do that. And couldn't make out a lot of what was being said, just a lot of screaming.
According to Chris, after the argument, Karen left the house for a walk, headed to the Buy for Less convenience store for some personal items a few blocks away. Chris left too, driving to a local bar for a few drinks, staying until about midnight. The next morning, Chris called Karen's office to see if she had reported to work. Her supervisor said she hadn't shown up or even called in. Chris then phoned the police to report her missing. When the police arrived to take Chris's statement, they looked around briefly and reported seeing no evidence of foul play or anything out of place or unusual.
If a person is going to run away or leave her husband, she's not just going to walk away and leave everything behind. She's going to take the things that mean the most to her, especially when you're dealing with a woman, things of, you know, toiletries, makeup, and that kind of thing. And, of course, we found all those things intact in the bedroom and in the bathroom, and it was as if she just disappeared off the face of the earth without taking anything with her.
While the police were there, Chris mentioned that the house had been burglarized the night before while he was out drinking and that some items were missing. Police asked Chris to sign a waiver to allow a search of the house.
Then he agreed to do so and thought that would be good, and even commented that he hoped that we found something in the house that would help us with the investigation.
The first thing I recall seeing is the bed was against the south wall, and right next to the bed was a large white trash bag. And underneath that trash bag, I could see a very large brownish colored stain. Of course, the next thing we did was went and got some hemosticks, which we carried in our vehicle.
A hemostick is a chemical strip that can immediately tell whether or not blood is present.
Take the dry hemostick and with your finger just lightly smear it on the suspect stain to where some of it's transferred onto the hemostick. Take a drop of distilled water, put it on the hemostick, flick off the excess water, and you have a dark green, which is a positive presumptive test for the presence of blood.
The stain on the carpet was indeed blood, but was it human? And if so, Whose was it?
The first day we were in the house, I put on a pair of gloves, and that spot on that carpet was still moist. This piece of carpet and the padding was completely soaked with blood. It was such a massive amount of blood that there was still actual moisture involved there. It was not completely dried.
The carpet was removed and delivered to the Oklahoma City Police Department's forensic chemistry lab.
I went on to do a Ochterlony test. It's a specie determination test to determine as to whether or not that blood came from a human or an animal source.
It was human blood.
That was enough to convince me that we weren't dealing with a routine missing persons case.
The police needed more to go on and felt the answers lay inside the Campanos' house. When police discovered human blood inside the Campanos' bedroom, they suspected the bloodstain might belong to Karen Campano. They also suspected that Chris knew more about her disappearance than he was admitting.
She left at 7:30. What did you do then?
Under police questioning, Chris maintained that he knew nothing about his wife's whereabouts, but his alibi was weak. The bartender didn't recall seeing Chris Campano on the night of July 1st, and police discovered that Chris had pawned some of Karen's jewelry the morning after her disappearance. Without a body, the only thing left for the police to do was run more tests inside the house. There weren't any visible signs of violence besides the bloodstain they found in the bedroom.
We saw a typical little frame house for central Oklahoma City that, as you went inside, looked quite clean, quite neat. Things had been cleaned out of it. Walls looked clean, ceiling looked clean, the floor looked clean. So there wasn't much to see at all.
So they decided to look for blood which may have been cleaned up or wasn't visible to the naked eye. To do so, investigators used a special chemical solution called luminol, an extremely sensitive test which can detect blood which has been removed by water or even detergents and bleach.
Luminol is a fluorescence-type chemical. Spray it on a substance that may contain blood. It reacts with the heme group in the blood itself. The iron portions will luminesce or fluoresce.
To do the luminol test, investigators needed complete darkness. So they waited until nightfall. They began their chemical dragnet in the bedroom, where they discovered the stain on the carpet a few days earlier. First, they took photographs of the room, the way it looked to the naked eye. Then they sprayed the luminol. The results were astonishing.
There were some instances in that house where it glowed so brightly that you could actually see the person standing next to you. There was so much blood in there.
The luminol told a horrific tale. Blood had been everywhere. On the walls, the ceiling, on the doors.
It looked like a bloodbath had occurred there, something from a horror movie.
Even more telling was the blood spatter, which is the placement of the stains. Where they were located, the size of the drops, and the trails of blood all told a story. Someone had been beaten in the bedroom with a blunt object.
They were in two trails, what we refer to as cast-off trails. So if you had an object, for example, in your hand, and that object was blood-covered, and if you were swinging that object overhead, the centrifugal force of pulling the blood down to the end of the object will cast the blood in the direction the object is being swung. And in this case, it's going to the ceiling. There are two distinct trails, and you can tell that there's at least two swings with the blood-covered object.
Luminol was then applied to the rest of the house and even to the outside steps and walkways.
At one point, there's a swipe of blood that was on the kitchen door leading into the utility room that would have been about head level if you were carrying a body and had to turn the body sideways to get it through a normal door. And then at that point, it appeared the body was laid down on the ground and then drug from the utility room down the back steps.
And you could see pooled luminescence on each step and then drag marks that were luminescent all the way down the walkway until you got to the point that you were at the driveway, and at that point they disappeared. Very, very dramatic presentation.
The house was telling its story, one of an apparently gruesome attack. But there were still unanswered questions. Where was the body and the weapon? And was the blood Karen Campano's? Police still couldn't prove a murder had been committed. Although the police knew someone was violently attacked inside the Campano residence, they couldn't be sure a homicide had been committed. Was there enough blood in the Campano house to prove that someone was dead? And was that someone Karen Campano?
The investigators at a later time decided that we'd go back and try to do a measurement test to see how much blood had to have been let out on that carpet to make that size of a stain.
Police made sure their test was as accurate as possible. They used a piece of the original carpet as well as a weight to simulate a human head. Next, they poured human blood around the weight until they created a stain measuring 887 square inches, the same size stain they originally discovered.
Statistically, one could say that between 1,300 and 1,400 cc's of blood would create that stain.
That's more than 40% of the blood volume of a woman Karen Campano's size. No one could survive with that amount of blood loss.
So at that point, it became pretty apparent to me that if this lady was missing and if this lady was dead, that this lady probably was killed right there.
The authorities now knew a homicide had been committed in the house and that someone had died in the bedroom in a pool of blood. But was the victim Karen Campano? Police didn't have a sample of Karen Campano's blood to compare to the blood stain. If Karen's mother and father were still living, it would have been a simple matter to examine their DNA, since Karen would have received half of her DNA from her mother and half from her father, but Karen's father was deceased. The Oklahoma City Police Department asked the FBI to get involved to see if there was any way they could figure out whether the blood found in the house belonged to Karen Campano. The police obtained blood samples from Karen's mother, her two sisters, her three children, and one of her ex-husbands.
And so in this particular case, the object of the examination was to see if this DNA from the blood stain of unknown origin was matching. At least half of the DNA was matching to the relatives from Karen Campano.
Hal Dedman of the FBI's DNA analysis unit conducted what is called RFLP analysis, analyzing pieces of DNA from four different chromosomes. This is the DNA profile of Karen Campano's mother. And next to it, on either side, are two of her daughters, Karen Campano's sisters. Both daughters share half of their DNA with their mother. This lane shows a DNA sample from one of Karen Campano's ex-husbands. The next lane shows a sample from his son, whose mother was Karen Campano. The father and son both share the upper band. The son would have received the lower band from his mother, which matches the band from his grandmother, Karen's mother. The next autorad compares the family member's DNA to the unknown blood stain found in the Campano home. The top marker matches the genetic profile from the first of Karen Campano's children. And the markers from the blood stain also match the bands from Karen Campano's two other children from another marriage.
Results were fairly straightforward. They were totally consistent with the blood coming from Karen Campano.
8 months after the disappearance of Karen Campano, police concluded that Christopher Campano murdered his wife and was arrested. All of the evidence pointed towards Chris Campano. The forensic evidence, the argument neighbors heard on the night of Karen's disappearance, Chris's lack of an alibi for the entire evening, and the fact that he pawned some of her things. The prosecution believed that Karen Campano never left her house for a walk, as her husband had suggested. Neighbors heard Karen and Chris arguing that night, and the forensic evidence suggests that the argument moved to their bedroom, where it escalated and turned violent. As Chris stood near the window, he struck Karen in the head with a blunt object, at least three times, possibly more, producing the cast-off blood trails on the ceiling and walls. Karen fell to the floor, her head striking the bedpost where her blood was also found. As Karen lay bleeding from her massive head injuries, Chris left and went to a local bar. He needed to wait until the neighbors were asleep before removing Karen's body. When he returned home, he wrapped Karen's body in a sheet with a telephone wire and carried her through the house. Luminol tests showed that Karen's head brushed against the door, leaving a blood smear, later cleaned with detergent. Chris then dropped the body onto the floor and dragged it through the side door and out towards the car. He probably disposed of her body late that night in a deserted location. After returning home, Chris removed all visible traces of blood both inside and out. The DNA analysis showed the blood found on the carpet belonged to Karen Campano. And the medical examiner would testify that Karen Campano suffered horrendous head injuries during the attack, which no one could survive. Prosecutors were confident of a conviction, even though they didn't have a body or a murder weapon.
Well, I thought it was very likely we might never find the body of the victim.
But just as the preliminary hearing was set to get underway, everything changed. The police found Karen Campano.
This part right here wasn't quite so grown up with all this ivy, and she was laying right down there by that large cottonwood tree, north to south, and there were some blankets around her. There was no greenery at that time. If there had been greenery at that time, you'd never know she was there.
The body lay in a remote area off a major interstate highway until some youngsters on dirt bikes stumbled across it.
All we knew was that we had a female's body out there. We had no idea who it was. Of course, we were hoping it was Karen, but we didn't know.
There was another important find. Police discovered a piece of a check underneath the body. Although they couldn't determine to whom the check was issued, it was from the Shell Oil Company and mailed to someone in New York. The check was for $83.34. Karen Campano was from New York, and her family had a part interest in a gas station there.
This was the first definitive piece that we had that we knew at that point there was a great possibility that it was Karen. And of course, we wouldn't know for sure until they made identification through dental records and DNA.
Dr. Tom Glass heads the Forensic Odontology Department at the University of Oklahoma. With the help of Karen Campano's dental records and an almost complete set of teeth found in the skull of the body, Dr. Glass's task was fairly easy.
What I do in making the comparison then is simply go frame by frame by frame of the patient's antemortem dental x-rays, the x-rays made by the dentist, with the frames of the same areas made on the skeletonized remains. She had a very thorough dentist who documented what he had done. And that documentation allowed the identification in Karen Campano's case to be very profound.
And a DNA analysis of the bone marrow confirmed it. The last doubts had been removed.
Personally, I'm glad she was eventually found because of the family back in New York. I talked to him at length over the phone. Later on during the investigation, I met him. They're really great people, and I really had strong feelings for them, hoping one day she would be found so they could put their own fears to rest and give her a decent burial.
And Christopher Campano confessed. The remarkable thing about it, the autopsy confirmed the prosecution's theory of how Karen died. And that theory, remember, was based only on the luminol, the blood spatter analysis, and the blood volume tests.
the maxilla were fractured, the mandibles were fractured, the nose was fractured, the sinuses were fractured, the skull was extensively fractured, yet the cervical spine was intact and there were only three fractures in the ribs. So this is not the hallmark of somebody that's been run over by a car or somebody who's had a train wreck or something like that. This is the hallmark of someone who has sustained a severe beating about the head and face. So it was obvious that this was an assault.
Police and forensic science had solved a difficult puzzle.
It all told a story. It was just more of the pieces of the puzzle coming together, even all the way to the end when the body was actually found. It's like, you know, we've got most of the puzzle there. You know what it is, even with some missing pieces, you know what it is. But then with that body found, it was like that was the very last piece that just fit in there.
In January of 1994, a year and a half after Karen was killed, Christopher Campano went on trial for his life. His defense attorney couldn't refute the forensic findings. They were just too strong.
Once I had decided to make that leap and embrace the evidence, then my task became easier. It was a matter then of looking at the psychological aspects of the case rather than the hard forensics of the case. I suggested to the judge and jury if it was going to be deliberately planned out and methodical, that kind of blood wouldn't be there. There would be none in the house, probably. The homicide would have occurred elsewhere if it had been a cold-blooded killing.
The jury bought at least part of the argument. It found Campano guilty of manslaughter, not the first-degree murder charge the state was seeking.
I feel sorry for it. I feel sorry for what I did to her. I can't bring her back, you know. I just got to pay for what I've done.
Christopher Campano was sentenced to 1,000 years in prison.